Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Capital Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can reach us through restaurantguysradio.com, WCTCAM.com, or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. I'm well and well into 2009. Started off the year with a bang. Don't know if I gave you the whole lowdown of what happened to the restaurant over this weekend, but I'll share it with you at the same time that I share with our listeners.
I'm ready. I was there for a lot of it, though, so I'd be surprised if I missed anything.
Well, you see, Saturday night after we left, it was kind of a quiet night, beginning of the new year. Saturday night after we left, I went home. I'll tell you what I did. I was really enjoying my new house. It was very cold outside. Grabbed my rocking chair. I kid you not. And it's actually my mother's rocking chair. It's been in the family a long time. And I was enjoying my living. I had a roaring fire going.
I don't fit in my mother's rocking chair.
I got a roaring fire going, pulled the rocking chair up, grabbed a bunch of reading, a lot of restaurant reading, actually. I wish I could say it was a novel, but it was some restaurant reading. It was some stuff I've been meaning to get to for a long time. Had the fire going. I had a scotch. I had an Auchentoshan Lowland scotch and a beautiful cigar. And I lit the cigar, and I smoked the cigar, and I read the book, and I sat by the fire, and I played classical music, and it was wonderful. And I thought, you know, it's always slow the first week of the new year, but, you know, I guess I got to come home early on a Saturday night and just enjoy my house. About 2.5 hours went by. I sat there and read for about 2.5 hours. It was lovely. Phone rang. Here's what our bartender, Caitlin, said. Okay, Francis, I don't want you to be alarmed. The explosion didn't damage the building at all.
You did not share with me the exact quote there.
Yeah. The explosion didn't damage the building at all. And what had happened was evidently...
And immediately you're thinking, was the explosion inside the building or outside of the building?
It started explosion and building, and it was bad. So I, as she's explaining it to me, I haven't driven anywhere in my pajamas in a long time. But I'm racing to New Brunswick as she's explaining.
I can see you in your pajamas and your leather coat and your long leather coat.
Leather coat, floppy slippers, left the teddy bear at home. And so I'm racing toward New Brunswick. And it turns out it was quite the scene. And I feel fortunate that we've dodged this bullet in early 09. There was an explosion underground in New Brunswick. An underground transformer blew. And there's a sidewalk grate right in front of the theater that's right next to him. When I say right next to him, I mean 6 inches from our restaurant building. And it's a sidewalk grate that's maybe 5 feet by 4 feet. And fire and smoke and sparks are shooting 4 feet into the air.
Kind of like the picture, the vision you get, I get in my head when Francis talks about this, knowing where the grates are, is think of the gates of hell are opening, and it's like a bad scene from the show Charmed.
Right, exactly. It's there. Well, and so as I pull into New Brunswick, the skyline of New Brunswick becomes in view from Route 18. And from Route 18, I see smoke billowing up into the air and the red lights of fire trucks and emergency vehicles, and I know that it's all coming from right in front of my restaurant.
And Route 18 is you know, half a mile from the restaurant.
So I pull up, they've got the whole street cordoned off, and they let me on the other side of the police tape, and there's literally, out of every manhole cover and sidewalk grate, there are smoke and fire shooting up down this, you know, Livingston Avenue is a wide street with theaters and hotels and our damn restaurant right there. And there are firemen everywhere. New Brunswick has a lot of fire trucks, evidently. I know this for sure now. And, so it was a transformer that blew. We didn't even lose power. Nobody was hurt. But, boy, it looked like something else.
Well, and so they spent the next 3 days basically fixing these transformers in the street. And happily, I'm not sure why, but these transformers don't bring power to our restaurant, even though they are directly out in front of our restaurant.
Yeah, we didn't lose power.
So we didn't lose power. What Francis neglects to mention is we did spend the next 3 days with cordoned off like he was talking about. So you could still get into the restaurant, but we really didn't look like we were open.
You had to cross the crime scene
and
tape.
And there was the yellow crime scene investigation tape was out in front of the restaurant.
It's not really good for walk-in business. Well, I wouldn't choose to be at a crime. And there were, I don't know, a dozen public service trucks with their lights going, so the yellow light flashing giving you a headache. Fortunately, it was Sunday, Monday after New Year's, so it was a slow time anyway, but oh my.
Well, you could see from up in Catherine Lombardi, you could see just that there were lights flashing. You couldn't see that there, because the police cars was a little closer to the building than if you were sitting back. You couldn't actually see that it was a police car, but you could see the flashing lights. So what I kept telling people, it was Catherine Lombardi's Christmas tree was just blinking, and it's, you know, red, yellow.
Your grandmother had one of those
blue
wild Christmas trees. Well,
that constantly sparkled.
All I have to say is I feel that we're very fortunate. I feel that the good luck is with us. I don't view it as a negative thing. I view it as a positive thing, and 09 is going to be a great year.
That things can blow up and us not be one of them.
And nobody got hurt, exactly. Anyway, well, we'll be back in just a moment. We're going to be talking with Dana Cowan, editor of Food & Wine magazine, about what's going on in 2009. So stick with us. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTCAM.com and RestaurantGuysRadio.com.
Hey, Francis, what's your first choice of hotel in New Jersey?
Easy question, Mark. It's the Heldrich Hotel and Conference Center.
You stay there because it's so convenient, right across the street from the restaurants, right?
I stay there because it's awesome. The rooms are elegant and stylish and comfortable. The service is slick and professional and kind. Did you know they have a swimming pool and a full-service spa?
You know you're a decadent guy, right?
I do, and that's why I stay at the Heldrich.
Well, I stay there for more practical reasons. It's right in the heart of New Brunswick, so you can walk to all the great restaurants and brew pubs and cafes and three world-class theaters. You can even catch the train to Manhattan and be there in less than an hour. And if you want to dine or have a drink in the hotel, Christopher's Restaurant and Bar is right there.
The Heldrich is also great for business. In our dining rooms, we meet a ton of people who book corporate events, meetings, and conferences there, and they're all happy. With 248 rooms, 14 suites, and over 25,000 square feet of state-of-the-art meeting and conference space, the Heldrich can do up to 450 for meetings, social events, and even great weddings.
It's only 25 minutes from Newark Airport. There's a direct train from New Brunswick and frequent shuttles. How easy is that?
To plan a meeting or book a leisurely getaway, call the Heldrich at 866-609-4700. Visit theheldrich.com or click through the link on our website. Ask for the Restaurant Guys promo or online enter promo code Catherine to get a special rate just for our listeners. That's 866-609-4700, theheldrich.com, or click the link on Restaurant Guys Radio. The promo code is Catherine. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys, and our guest today is Dana Cowan. She is editor of Food & Wine magazine and becoming a regular guest on our show.
Dana, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, it's nice to have you back. It's January 2009, and it's a pretty scary time in the food world, isn't it? So we're on the verge of what are we on the verge of, Dana?
I think maybe I should stick to the happy side of the food world, because I see some really, you know, great things going on. I think there's enough focus from other people on all the scary bits. I'm looking forward to eating some really great food in 2009. So I'll focus on that. A huge wave of Italian restaurants that are opening all across the country, which are going to bring us incredible, incredible food.
Now, when you talk about Italian restaurants, are you talking about that Brooklyn Italian that we know from our roots in Brooklyn, or are you talking about, you know, regional Italian cuisine from the different regions of Italy?
Happily, it is everything. It's everything from Salumeria Maria Rossi, which is on the Upper West Side in Manhattan, where you can sit down and have a fantastic lasagna for under $10 and some charcuterie and a great glass of wine, all the way to, you know, those fantastic guys, Lachlan McKinnon Patterson and Bobby Stuckey, who have Frasca Food & Wine in Boulder, Colorado. Well, they're opening an Il Cafe at Frasca, so they're going to do sort of more down-home food. Or, you know, Mario Batali, going into Westchester. I'm so excited to have amazing food in the suburbs. Not that it's going to be the first place I go, but my brother's sure going to make my brother happy. In San Francisco, there's a new restaurant called Urbino that's from the A16 people, and they are so talented, and they have a new cookbook coming out. I mean, the list, honestly, could take up the complete amount of time we have to talk to together today.
Well, you know, Francis started out the show talking about, you know, the economic downturn, but sometimes an economic downturn creates new opportunities for new kinds of places and maybe gets people out of some of the ruts that they were in.
I think that's right. I think that we're seeing the extreme of the downturn now, but really in the food world, we've felt it coming for quite some time, as you know. So there are chefs and restaurateurs who've had restaurants in the works that sort of break the mold and are more low-key. And so those restaurants that have been online for such a long time are going to be opening soon. So you've got Bobby Flay doing burgers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd love to go into essentially a fast food place and have a Bobby Flay burger. You know, the same thing with sandwich shops. I mean, chefs have this passion for sandwiches. It's what they have after service at 2 in the morning. And they're turning that passion into, shops around the country. Also, chefs, you know, opening their mind to what might they do that isn't a straight-ahead restaurant, you know. And so chefs are opening ancillary projects like great butcher shops. You know, Tim Love down in Texas is opening a butcher shop. Barbara Lynch, who, has so much going on in Boston, you know, she's got a great cocktail bar now, and she's got her restaurants, but she's, you know, going into butchery. So I think that it does, a downturn does make people think differently, and I think we're going to benefit from that.
I think one of the things that I see from my friends and even from us, from Francis and me, we see that we become more creative again. You're forced into, and I don't mean forced, but you certainly are prodded into kind of thinking again about things, that rethinking some of the things that were tried and true, and saying, you know what, let's spice this up a little bit. Francis and I teach a wine course in the restaurant, and it's got a very different turn and feel to it this year than it's had for the last 16.
I'm seeing out in my travels when I eat out and also coming into our restaurants and the like, it's not necessarily reflective of, you know, it's not really a downer in the food scene. There's a lot of cool stuff going on in the food world, but there's a different ethos. I mean, I think our restaurants reflect, and on what we eat at home and our food publications like Food and Wine, they reflect the mood of the country, and I think that's one of the reasons you're seeing a lot of Italian restaurants. I don't know, how do you think it affects the mood of folks? I think people look at dining a little differently. It's almost...
I think it's an interesting time for, an economic downturn to come in terms of people's sophistication in terms of food, right? For years, people have been going out more and more and more, and so their palates are heightened, and they're expecting when they put something in their mouth for it to be really incredibly delicious. So I think that as people are pulling back a little bit, going out to restaurants perhaps a little bit less, or ordering, less expensive food at restaurants, what they cook at home has become more creative, and they're experiencing really great flavors at home. So I think that you'll see people looking at packaged goods differently. Packaged goods have, you know, ramped up over the last, 5 years as people have gotten more sophisticated. So there are more interesting products in the market. And so you can get something in a jar that's going to, you know, you can add to your grilled chicken, and you're not going to have a restaurant experience at home, but I think that, you know, you can get creative at home in ways that, you know, you hadn't before. And I think that what people feel at a time like this, particularly when it's winter, is an urge for comfort food, which is exactly the Italian sensibility, and the notion that, you know, you want something that's satisfying and not necessarily shocking. You know, you're not looking to shock your palate. You're looking to bring comfort, which means bringing family and friends together and lots of good wine. I mean, I think wine has, to date, done incredibly well. And so I think we're going to see just that that craving for familiarity. And the restaurants that are opening and the food people are craving reflect that.
I think that's true. I think you see things like from an overemphasis on the most expensive, luxurious ingredient you could find, which really led the way through the 90s and then again picked up steam in the aughts, in the early and mid-aughts, to, you know, I'm seeing leg of lamb everywhere.
You're so right. We were just talking about that today. Isn't that funny? We've seen leg of lamb everywhere, which it puzzles me. I mean, lamb to replace pork, it just can't be.
leg of lamb, very flavorful, though.
But I was going to ask you about that as well. I don't think it's replaced pork at all. I think we are downright fetishizing pork in the country now. And Mark and I have always, you know, pork is the magical animal that creates bacon and sausage and ham and Toronto. But I think, you know, we see Porchetta in Manhattan.
That place.
Isn't that great? Little sandwich takeout. Awesome. But you see pork everywhere. But I see pork and I see leg of lamb. And I see maybe, you know, for a while there was an emphasis on, I remember the first time for me in my life, I'm 43. But I remember when Allison on Dominic, Tom Valenti was at Allison on Dominic, and it was lamb shanks were the thing. And people thought, and then lamb shanks were like a buck, you know, and Tom Valenti was making dinner with lamb shanks and braised meats. And then we went to Cheeks and Mario Batali, I think, was the first big proponent of Cheeks that I recall.
Cheeks and jowl.
Cheeks and jowls, yeah.
I mean, one of the things that I've noticed that I think about how we might investigate affordable recipes for the readers is that a lot of those cuts that were really cheap back then, I mean, you know, ribs and the prices have gone up. There's not that much that's cheap which I think brings us to a Michael Pollan point, which is, you know what? Meat should be more expensive. Mm-hmm. We actually should get meat out of the center of our plate and we should, you know, have a more vegetable, green-based diet, and meat as a condiment is a valuable thing, and a way that we might go for many reasons. I mean, not, you know, one of which is because it's expensive, but another because it's of the way meat is produced in this country.
Yeah, are you aware, Dana, that on a wholesale level right now, you can spend more for veal ossobuco than veal tenderloin if you're not shopping,
really?
Right? You can spend, it can actually be more per pound.
Okay, that's extraordinary to me. I mean, I knew pricey, but that's crazy.
It is. Veal ossobuco right now has, and it, you know, it goes back and forth, but they're very close price-wise. Veal tenderloin to veal ossobuco.
I think that speaks to
explain that to me. I don't know why.
Well, I think that speaks to what becomes fashionable. You know, that it was, back when you were looking at that in December, I guess, you know, it's supply and demand, but it's also, I mean, let's look at the bigger picture overall. Like, when we talked about, you know, when Tom Valenti turned to lamb shanks as sort of for, you know, lamb ossobuco, one of the reasons was because they were so cheap. But like you said, they've grown in price to where it's all crazy expensive, you know. And now I think what you are seeing still with pork, you still have some things like pork belly, which is very fashionable right now, where the meat itself, even from good pork, is not crazy expensive.
Right.
But I think you're absolutely right about meat being at the center of the plate and people and trying to look to Americans to reduce the amount of meat we intake. But I don't see it happening. I think people are feel that if they don't have meat every day, it's they're somehow really suffering.
Well, when you talk about economical, though, I think that Dana brings up a good point. And you see a lot of Italian restaurants, and what do a lot of Italian restaurants provide you?
Pasta.
They provide, well, pasta or gnocchi or other types of center of the plate that aren't necessarily focused on what the meat is, though there may be meat on the plate.
Absolutely, and that are incredibly satisfying. I mean, who's not happy with a plate of pasta? And thank heavens we've gotten over our you know, carb phobia, because this would be a very bad time to be carb phobic.
Oh, yeah. Well, and you know, any extreme fad diet like that is just, and it was crazy. And even in the fine dining restaurants, you'd have people come in and order just all protein. And, you know, look, I've been around food, we've all been around, we all eat, right? But we're food professionals, but I'm not a doctor. But I'd look at what people were eating, and I'm thinking, you're going to die.
this was not a good choice.
You're not a wolf. Sir, you know, you can't live on that.
You just ordered 2.5 pounds of bacon.
We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, Dana, will you talk to us about a city that's near and dear to our heart, Philadelphia. You've written quite a bit about Philadelphia recently. Can we talk about the food scene there?
Sure, though. I wish I had been back to Philadelphia more recently, but my memory stretches.
Extraordinary. We'll be back in just a moment with Dana Cowan. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, WCTCAM and RestaurantGuysRadio.com. The Feluga family at the Livio Feluga Winery are masters of modern winemaking, rooted deeply in Italian tradition. Founder and patriarch Livio Feluga has been counted among the 7 most influential Italian winemakers in the last 100 years. Signore Feluga pioneered the Friuli method. It's a style of winemaking that focuses on the purity of the fruit and the expression of the soil. It's made Livio Feluga Pinot Grigio the standard bearer for high-quality artisanal Pinot Grigio. It's serious, interesting, deeply rooted wine that speaks of the very essence of Friuli, from whence it comes. But with Livio Feluga, it's not only Pinot Grigio. Feluga wines offer a world of adventurous choices. Have you ever had a wonderful Ribolla Gialla or a Picolite? Well, if you haven't, then you're missing some very special Italian wine indeed. Feluga makes red wines like Verdigo, which is Cabernet and Merlot, or Sasso, which is made with the Italian grapes Refosco and Pignolo. Start with Pinot Grigio, the way it's supposed to be, and then, through the efforts of Livio Feluga, take a tour of Friuli, glass by glass, sip by sip. Ask for Livio Feluga wines at your local wine shop, or look for them online. Tell them you heard about it on The Restaurant Guys. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We're talking with Dana Cowan, editor of Food & Wine magazine. I wanted to bring up, a while back you had written about Philadelphia and the Philadelphia food scene. And I think that Philadelphia is an interesting town because it's so close to New York, but it never really goes to the excesses or the excessive heights of New York. But you've got places like Vetri there. Because of the crazy liquor laws in Philadelphia, you've got a lot of BYOs. And it strikes me as a really homey place. I think that do you think that food can maybe move in that is maybe moving in that direction, or the restaurant scene is moving in that direction?
Well, I think Philadelphia is such an interesting city to look at in terms of restaurant food, because you have people who care a lot about food, but they're not going for the blockbuster meals there. So when I went to Philadelphia and I was trying to assess whether it's a great food city or not, I was looking for the equivalent of a Thomas Keller restaurant like the French Laundry or Per Se, or something as extremely refined and expensive as Bar Massa, and I didn't find that. But what I found was incredibly satisfying, diverse food with passionate cooks. And what I loved about what I found in Philadelphia that would be phenomenal if it was replicated across the country, is chefs who are completely in touch with their customers. And I think when you have a chef who's in touch with their customer, then you end up with more casual, comforting restaurants. Because what does somebody come back for time and again to a restaurant? You know, you don't necessarily come back time and again to, you know, something that's gelled and tweaked with, you know, 20 herbs on it that you can't quite decipher and can't quite remember. It's sort of the food equivalent of, you know, a catchy Broadway song is like a meatball, you know. It's not a tortured sashimi. So I feel that in the future we will see more what you could call jingle food, you know, food that's immediately accessible, like A16, which I mentioned. Once in San Francisco, where the food is, it's, you know, pizza, but it's so much more than pizza. It's just great.
Well, I think that one of the things you mentioned, and one of the reasons I mentioned Philadelphia and Vetri in particular, is that you're seeing a desire among the dining public to see chefs in their restaurants. At the same time as you see celebrity chefs play more and more of a role in our society, which I think can be a very good thing, especially when you got somebody like, say, Colicchio, who's just, you know, he's a great role model, he's a great guy, he's a great chef and a great cook and a great businessman. But even he is, you know, it was a real special thing to see him cooking in his own restaurants. You could go and have a meal with him actually in the kitchen again.
Right.
And it's kind of an odd thing that we find ourselves where like, oh, it's a special occasion. The chef is going to cook in his restaurant. You know, I think that there's a real yearning to have chefs back in their restaurants.
To remake that connection.
Do you see that?
Yeah, I think what's happening is that people want to be connected to their food, which sometimes means knowing the farm that the animal came from or knowing, you know, who made the chef. But it's also knowing who actually made the food.
Uh-huh.
One of the most exciting dining experiences that I've had of the year was going to Momofuku Co., which is a David Chang 12-seat restaurant in East Village where you sit at a counter and watch the chef cook for you. That's at the high end. But equally interesting to me is going to Yakitori Toto, which is, imagine, a Japanese yakitori restaurant where, again, you sit at a counter and you watch the person cook for you. The immediacy of, you know, watching your food be made and also having the scent, you know, the smell of it coming in so good, I feel like that is a direction that we've taken over the years, which not only says the chef is in the kitchen, but the chef is actually making this personally and particularly for you.
And I think it's important to let our listeners who aren't in the New York area know these places that we're talking about are not hibachi bars. it's a
right.
Very, very different thing.
There will be no shrimp in your hat.
No shrimp in your hat by the end of the meal.
You know, it's funny. I moved into an old house out here in the wilds of New Jersey, and I'm always fascinated with old houses and old buildings, and I'm fascinated with architecture and the evolution of manners. And there's a wonderful book by a woman named Margaret Visser called You know what's the rites
and
rituals,
rituals
of
dinner.
Right.
It's a wonderful book about manners, and it starts with an account of conquistadors watching several of their compatriots be devoured by cannibals, and then it ends with a formal state dinner in the White House. I mean, this is she really goes the gamut of manners. But in old Victorian houses and pre-Victorian houses, they would design a grand house with the kitchen very far away from the dining room. And you may wonder why that is. And it's because it was considered rude to have kitchen smells wafting into your dining room. It was like it was considered rude to comment on the food. You'd never say, oh, the food was wonderful. That was sort of a secondary thing. And, you know, how far we've come, how much we've changed that, you know, we go to a restaurant and we want to sit there and watch the food, and we design our homes with eating areas right in our kitchens, you know?
Absolutely, the most trafficked part of the house.
It is the beating heart of the house.
I can't have a dinner party and get people out of my kitchen.
Yeah, exactly.
I can't do it. Anytime I have a dinner party, there is a congestion of people in my kitchen.
You know, and that brings us to the next topic that we wanted to talk about, the idea of looking at the chef. I think in Food and Wine, you've been covering a lot of the cocktail scene, which I love and we are a big proponent of. But there's been a real, in the last 5 to 7 years, started by Dale DeGroff 12 years ago, there's been a tremendous cocktail revolution in the country, and the line between bartender and chef is blurring a little, isn't it?
Right. I mean, we see the bartenders really as bar chefs, and then some bar owners actually, you know, being like restaurateurs. So Julie Reiner at Clover Club, for example, calls herself a barateur. and I think that, yes, we have taken cocktails incredibly seriously, and those people behind the bars, I mean, they go shopping at the Green Market. That's the crossover to chefdom. You know, they're using seasonal ingredients, and they're creating, you know, one-of-a-kind or cocktails one at a time. They're handcrafted. They're artisanal. The liquors that they use, they're incredibly picky about, the same way somebody would be picky about, you know, where their port came from. Now, the bar chefs, whatever you want to call them, are, you know, ever more precise about the shades of the different, the nuances of the alcohol that they use. And I think what happens is you get some really great drinks that way, but in the same way that, you know, foam in the wrong hands is just foam, you know, fancy cocktails in the wrong hands are just dreadful drinks. But on the whole, I think, you know, you can go into most restaurants now and have a fantastic cocktail list.
Sure, but you can get a cocktail that tastes like soap. There's no doubt about it.
Well, but I also think that, you know, the bartender has always been directly in touch with the customers. And, you know, we talk about open kitchens. The bar has always been open. I was in Death & Company the other night. And the bartender is a friend. Joaquin is a friend.
Uh-huh.
And he was, you know, I ordered a punch. And, you know, he made a punch for four. And it was just a lovely thing on a cold evening to have happen, and I agree completely. So what are the trends?
Of course, just one thought about the punches. You know, we've seen it takes you right back to the Victorian era and politesse. You know, he probably was serving you a punch out of a really beautiful punch bowl.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've seen lots of cocktailians, you know, source great old punch bowls on eBay and great old vintage glasses. So there's really a little taste of home in
mm-hmm.
some of these places.
Dana, you're giving out my sources now.
Okay. You know, we've done a punch every weekend. We run our version of a cocktail party where we take one of our specialty cocktails and offer it at a discount and pass some hors d'oeuvres. And over the holidays, we used two different punches, and one of them actually was one that appeared in the current issue of your magazine. I think is the Philadelphia Fish House punch.
Oh yeah.
And
that's a great punch.
I thought that I was like, hey, she's stealing our stuff. No, I wasn't at all. But the Philadelphia Fish House punch was tremendous, and we decided to use it because I recently went to, and this isn't just an American scene, although cocktails are a uniquely American invention. I got my recipe for the Philadelphia Fish House punch at a friend's bar in Belfast. A guy named Hayden Lambert owns works in the Merchant Hotel there, and here I am in Belfast having a Philadelphia Fish House punch. Well, I have to do this. I'm a lot closer to Philadelphia than Belfast, and so that's what brought us down. But people love the idea of a communal punch bowl.
Well, and that brings us, you know, to the notion of how important communal is in food and in the world at large. Like, would social networking be so large if we were not interested in connecting? And there's something about sharing food and just sharing the same bowl that makes us feel a little bit more connected, and we all want to feel a little bit more connected.
You know, and we also, we're talking a lot about people doing things in their home, and we had Anthony Giglio on, and he said the first thing when someone walks into your home, they should be greeted, and they should be greeted with a cocktail.
Uh-huh.
And a great way to do that is with a punch.
Right.
To have a punch ready so that when someone walks in the door, they can immediately be accosted with alcohol.
And we admire the spirit. I wanna before we let you go, Dana, I just want to point out in the current February issue of Food & Wine magazine, you list personally you 10 sources of fine chocolates.
Oh, yes.
And I just got this magazine last night, and I want to direct people to foodandwine.com. Can they get the list on foodandwine.com?
Yes, they can.
Well, there's a great list of chocolates there. Can I ask what your criterion is for a great chocolate?
Well, that is such a good question. We have veteran tasters here,
mm-hmm.
and we don't set a criteria other than it has to taste fantastic and wow us, and then it has to wow six people. So if it wows one person, it sort of doesn't win. And I will tell you, we probably taste more chocolate than any other single ingredient throughout the year.
Really?
And so when we came to do this taste test, it was the distillation of really a year's worth and then multiple years' worth of chocolate tasting. So we look for different things in the different chocolates, but we tend to like things that are a little bitter, although you'll see in that same February issue, we did an ode to milk chocolate.
I saw that.
Yeah, that was great.
So you're hoping that people will see the light, I think is what you said.
Yeah. That, you're so right. It was a bad pun, but I let it go. I think I wrote it even. But, you know, so we don't say that the only chocolate is this, you know, dark chocolate. But it was very personal. That's the short answer. It was personal.
The things
that are on the list, we loved.
Well, I when I got the magazine last night, and I just got the current issue last night and began to read through it for today's show, I thought, because I may as well make the announcement on this show. It's odd that we're going to make the announcement on this particular show, and this should be so fortuitous, but Mark and I have just launched our own chocolate company.
Oh, my gosh, that's fantastic. sick.
Isn't that wild? Yeah.
What kind of, will you do bars? Will you do?
We're just bonbons for now. We're probably going to introduce some hot chocolate for next year, but we just have bonbons. They're very fresh, very perishable.
Started with 5 flavors.
And we're probably going to produce 5 or 10 flavors at a time and no more than that.
That's fabulous.
Isn't that wild? So,
and where will they be available?
If you want to check them out, we're going to send you a box because next year I at least want to be in the running for when you do your chocolate thing. But people can pick them up. The website went live literally at 9 o'clock this morning. It's restaurantguyschocolate.com.
Wonderful.
And we're going to put up some links to the restaurantguys.com and stayzoff.com and kathleenbarty.com. And so if we send you some chocolates, will you taste them and tell you what you think?
We absolutely will. All 6 of us.
All right. It's a deal.
So we need to send you a lot of chocolates, is what you just said.
The big box is what we need to send.
Dana,
thanks so much for coming on the show again. It's wonderful to talk to you, as always.
Thank you. It's great to talk to you.
Thanks, Dana.
Dana Cowan is the editor of Food & Wine magazine. She joins us occasionally to tell us what's going on in the world outside of New Jersey. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, restaurantguysradio.com and WCTCAM.com. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. Dana Cowan is great. She's love having her on the show all the time. She has her finger on the pulse of the nation. Wish I had her job.
Well, one of the things I like about Food & Wine magazine, and obviously a lot of their offices are in New York City, but it's a nationwide magazine.
Yeah.
She's really, you know, they're traveling to other cities in the country, some large, some small. And she's really got a grasp of what's going on countrywide, not just New York-centric.
But did you hear that she gets to taste chocolate all year long? It's a thing they taste more than anything. That's what she said. I was actually, when we got this magazine that came out just last night and we saw that they rated chocolates, we were like, darn it, if we had only gotten our chocolates there. But literally, we just launched our website today. But I think some of their choices are interesting. They're not all just high-end chocolates. Mm-hmm. Like, they have Jacques Torres on here, who's been a guest on the show. But what she picked from him was his caramel chocolate popcorn, which is delicious, by the way.
Sure.
My favorite things from Jacques Torres are his caramel chocolate popcorn and his hot chocolate mix.
That's kind of all of a sudden, I guess the mainstream brand is Harry and David's Moose Munch. The chocolate-covered caramel corn.
I love Moose Munch.
I cannot tell a lie. I have a weak spot for chocolate. Oh. Just the combination of that salty, sweet, add the chocolate in there, some nuts. There's a combination there that really hits that pleasure center in my brain.
Odd combinations. The number one chocolate, ready? Christopher Elbow number 6 Dark Rocks. They're dark chocolate rock-covered pop rocks. 14 bars with popping candy in them.
Really?
I don't know how that made the top 10, Dana. We should have got her on the. You know, we got to have her back.
I wish we had talked about that on the air.
We can't talk about her after she's gone, but I'm like, I really only looked at them that they have on now. Nestle's $100,000 bar is on here.
Really?
Yeah, Nestle's $100,000 bar. They also have Scharfenberger semi sweet, which is delicious. Green and black, not the biggest fan of green and black. I don't know about you.
Green and black.
Just texturally doesn't work for me. You know, one of the things that's interesting about, say, Jacques Torres chocolate, one of our favorite chocolatiers in the world is a guy in Paris named Michel Chanon. Whenever anyone's in Paris, we ask them to bring us some. Isn't your sister supposed to be getting us some right now?
She is in Paris as we speak.
Well, she better come back with the chocolate if she's not
allowed
in the restaurant.
She better come back with the chocolate. I'm going to need to text her the address again, though, so just to double check that she remembers.
But one of the things we do with Michel Chardon chocolates is you ask her to pick it up on the last day,
If they'll do it on the last day or the day before, the chocolates are highly perishable. And when you talk about ingredients that go into some of these chocolates, and we're not talking about a chocolate bar that you would otherwise melt down and make something out of because they have some stability to them.
Right.
But we're talking about a confection, a finished product, and they just get worse over time. And sometimes that time, if it's a really artisanally made product, is very short.
Like in a bottle. For instance, we with our chocolates, and I hope this isn't too commercial, you check it out at restaurantguyschocolates.com. But like Chanon, when we make our the bonbon or the confection, it's with cream and butter and perishable ingredients, and it's very light. And as time goes on, we recommend they be eaten within 10 days. Because as time goes on, they get denser and denser. And eventually they'll bloom mold. I mean, within 2 weeks, some of these will bloom mold. it's not going to kill you, but it's not very pleasant to eat.
Right.
But that's
We haven't invented the blue cheese chocolate yet. That's not on the list.
But it's perishable because it's food. But I think that was one of the very interesting things. I give a lot of credit to the $100,000 bars of the world. It's an okay thing. I will have the occasional $100,000 bar once in a blue moon. And Reese's Peanut Butter Cup, I will have the occasional Reese's Peanut Butter Cup. But they're very stable, and as long as they don't get hot, you're fine. Whereas our stuff, we looked at the shipping for how we're going to ship our chocolates. We don't ship over the weekend. Mm-hmm. We only ship second day or overnight. And, we stop shipping on Thursday. And we can only make a certain amount.
And if you look at a lot of these, the gourmet chocolates online, like I said, Dana in Food and Wine Magazine, there's a link there to several of the chocolates she recommends. And if you look at a lot of these bonbons, these confections, they'll all tell you, you need to consume this in short order or it's not going to be pleasant.
Well, anyway, wherever you get your chocolate, I hope that you have a chocolate-filled 2009. I hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schock.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys on WCTCAM.com and RestaurantGuysRadio.com.